Hey, everybody, in a galaxy far, far away, or maybe right here on Earth, we like to think of space as the final frontier. Yeah, it's cliche, I know, but it's also kind of true, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, think of it as the cosmic canvas where, you know, mysteries unfold and then there's possibilities that never end up, like kind of cool sci-fi stuff. That's kind of where we find ourselves today, and that's what we're going to talk about. I've got an amazing guest today. Richard Anderson is here. Richard M. Anderson. Richard's not just any scientist. He's a microbiologist, an alumnus of San Jose State University, and he's even worked as a clinical laboratory bioanalyst. He's seen things under the microscope that you and I only think about or dream about in science fiction. He's also written this incredible book called The Evolution of Life, Big Bang to Space Colonies. And he dives into everything from the origins of life to our future among the stars. So I can't wait to talk to him and ride through the space-time continuum with somebody who's brilliant and insightful and has lots of cool ideas. And there we go. Richard, I feel like I should have done a countdown. Thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate you, the invitation.
Well, who do you want to do a shout out to? Let's start with that. We'll start with the easy stuff.
I really appreciate my publishing team that helped me with this book that I've published, and they're helping me with the book that I'm currently finishing up. So to the publisher, to the editors, to the artists that do some of the graphics.
Yeah,
I want to show my appreciation.
Awesome. And I totally understand that. Having a team help put together the show makes it what it is. And yay, teams, right? Right. Let's start with your book, The Evolution of Life, The Big Bang and Space Colonies. Briefly, like, explain the whole concept behind it. What is it about and why'd you write it?
Well, yeah, you know, when you're working in a career, you have family, you have obligations, you have vacations and all that sort of thing. You may along the way develop some questions about things you read and learn about that you don't have time to really investigate. So I always had a curiosity of how everything kind of ties together, or does it, from the origin of the universe to our present day. So that was my motivation, which started, and I started researching this slightly before COVID broke out.
Okay.
And then that outbreak kind of gave me an excuse to sequester myself and work on it. If that hadn't happened, I might not have started the book. So it's an attempt to show that from the Big Bang, the way it happened and the way matter and energy, the way energy was released and the way matter formed from energy, and then the way that evolved into atoms and molecules and planets and suns and eventually the complex molecules and life, and how that started, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
What the current thinking is. And then once life started, how did it evolve to produce people? I mean, we're pretty far out there when you think about microorganisms living at the bottom of the sea that are anaerobic, that for which oxygen is toxic for. We're far removed from that, but that's our origin. So yeah. How did that happen? So the book progresses through various, what I like to think of as pivot points in our evolution that ensured or kind of led to the next step and ultimately to us. So it was exciting to research. It was exciting to write about. And I hope it's exciting to read.
So things in the universe are ultimately mind-blowing to me, for sure. Like, we've got this, the space station, our telescope up there now that looks into the past, basically. Oh, we can see back, what, 13.3 billion years or so?
Yeah.
So the thing I don't understand is, how did the light or the Big Bang, which we can see with the telescope now, James Webb telescope, why isn't all that light past us yet? Instead of we're still looking at it, is there still light being emitted from that Big Bang, or what? How is it we're still seeing?
That's the original light, and the universe expanded. Actually, it expanded it faster than the speed of light. So that seems impossible, but light, the speed of light is the limitation of the speed of light is how light travels through the universe. So as the universe expands, in fact, right now at the edge of the universe, it's expanding faster than the speed of light. So that original Big Bang, that light started traveling toward us, but it gets stretched out, like that's what's called the red shift.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that's led to the success of the James Webb telescope, is that it can look in the far infrared part of the spectrum, which is beyond our visual range. So it's like you take a string that has, it looks like a worm. It's kind of wavy. Mm-hmm. And you pull both ends until it's straight. Well, the string is not quite straight, but it's very long wavelengths in the far infrared part of the spectrum. Okay. So it's at the edge. The light we receive is near the edge of the universe. What's beyond that, we can't see.
No. We definitely cannot see. So we've been around for what, like 13.8 billion years? That's how many times I guess we've gone around the sun. Are we going to make it to
13.9? Well, first let's take the 13.8 billion years. That's been established or accepted by physicists for some time now. There's been recent evidence, and some of it comes from the James Webb telescope, that the age of the universe may be twice that old. Okay.
Wow. Okay.
We'll go with 13.8 because they're finding out, as our instrumentation gets better and our science gets more sophisticated and our computer power becomes stronger, mm-hmm. we start to learn things that were beyond our capability before, so we can expect some changes in some of these numbers that have been kind of cast in stone. But right now we'll say 13.8 billion years.
Okay.
And then our solar system is about 4.6, 4.5 billion years, maybe 4.8 billion. I can't remember the number that they
projected. Another 100 million years, it's all good.
Yeah, a billion years. So, yeah. And then life started, trying to remember it, but it was a few billion years ago. Idea is life started pretty quickly after the formation of, after the Earth cooled enough. To okay. where water condensed on the surface again, and that point, we can look out into the clouds of the Milky Way. We can look at the dust particles and do spectral analysis, which is analyzing the light that comes through these the starlight that comes through mm-hmm. these clouds, and scientists have discovered. Organic molecules floating around out there, precursors of nucleic acids, which make up our DNA and RNA, complex organic molecules that we can assume probably rain down on Earth at some point. So we got a jump start, I think, and perhaps other areas in the universe as well got a jump start on life support or life starting.
Yeah. So in your estimation, do you think there are other either Earth-like planets or other planets where life does exist or not?
Well, I go into that in some detail in the book. And the answer is yes and no. So we could find, not in our immediate vicinity, which means out 10, 15 light years, but somewhere in our galaxy, I'm sure there are Earth-like planets. The problem is, or the consideration is, did they evolve in a similar way that Earth did? Right. And I think, so we have to look at that, because life, just because they may be habitable or close to habitable in present day, they may not have a history which would have allowed a life to evolve. Maybe start, but to evolve over a long period of time, which my thesis is that the time that we took to evolve is the time that's necessary for technological intelligence to evolve. The other thing is, our Earth is, as far as we know, pretty unique in that it has a higher density than it should have, which gives it a solid core, mm-hmm. with a surrounded by a liquid interior that allows a electromagnetic dynamic that gives us a radiation field that deflects a lot of harmful energy away from Earth to the poles, and that is uncommon. So the density of Earth is higher than Mars, as one would expect. The heavier elements will be gravitationally dispersed through a solar system. In other words, the more dense elements will tend to be toward the center. So that contributes directly to density. So Mars is less dense than Earth. Venus, however, is closer to the sun and is less dense than Earth. Mercury, which is the closest planet and rocky, is close to the density of Earth, but less. So why is that? Well, if you look at the Earth-Moon system and you added those two masses together, because the moon is the least dense object in the inner solar system.
Okay.
If you add those things, if you add the Earth and the moon together in one ball, it would have a density probably between Mars and Venus, which would be appropriate. So what happened was, a scientist theorized, and there is some evidence for this, but they theorized through a computer model that there was a planet in Earth's orbit at a balance point. Mm-hmm. And they named it Theia, Theia, I think. And that it perhaps at some point, a gravitational perturbation from Jupiter or maybe Venus kicked that off the balance point, and it collided with Earth, and it caused Earth to tilt at 13.2 to 13.5 degrees off of the solar system axis, mm-hmm. and increased the spin. The moon then spun off, the present day moon spun off, leaving behind some of its heavier elements, which increased the density of Earth and decreased the density of the moon. So it's kind of supported by the evidence from the Apollo missions, when they brought back moon rocks and they found the surface of the moon, the signature of the elements in the rocks were identical to the signature of the elements on Earth's surface. And so it indicates that the moon has an Earth source. The other thing that supports that is the moon is so large compared to the size of the Earth, mm-hmm. that if it came from the outer solar system and was captured gravitationally by the Earth, that wouldn't happen. It's too large. It's too large. The gravity wouldn't be, it would be slingshotted off, or it would, or it would collide.
Drop into the gravity well, and we'd have just boom.
Yeah. So that theory kind of limits the number of Earth-like planets out there if that has to happen. Interestingly enough, they've found another solar system, a proto-solar system, where the planets are still forming, and there are two planets in the same orbital in that system. So that supports the idea that that's something that could happen.
All right. All right. So what's the likelihood of life on other planets then? Is we're miraculous in that way?
I would say the likelihood of intelligent life, which takes a long time to evolve, or technologically intelligent life, which is what we consider ourselves, we can broadcast radio waves and so forth, mm-hmm. is very low. The likelihood of life starting on the microbial level and even persisting is probably fairly common. Given that all of these molecules are floating around in the clouds out there in space dust, that the matter in the universe, wherever it is the same. You know, the same physical laws apply everywhere. So I think life could start in many different places. And I think if we found a genesis somewhere else, it would be the most exciting thing ever to have been discovered. It wouldn't have to be intelligent. It'd probably be microbial. So
microbial would be still pretty cool, I have to say. Yeah. So and we are looking to get off of this planet and go to other things like the moon and then to Mars and then who knows where, some of the moons of Jupiter perhaps. Do you see that happening? Are we going to actually do that and get off the planet and live somewhere else?
The technology is there. So in the book that I'm writing right now is a science fiction book that springboards off the end of this nonfiction science book that I wrote. So I'm looking at the technology that it would take to get into space and to build space islands where people could live in perpetuity and reproduce and so forth and form societies. NASA did a study back in the 70s to see what kind of resources were in the solar system that could be used for that purpose, to develop bases, colonies, and other resources. And they found that the asteroid belt, which is between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter, contains enough material to build thousands of Earths.
Okay.
habitable environments. So there was recently an article in Discover magazine that discussed some of the hazards of space, living in space long term.
Mm-hmm.
We know we put people in orbit at a microgravity for upwards of a little more than a year at a time and found deleterious effects, loss of bone, loss of muscle, brain swelling. Some of the bone loss is not reversible. They tried to mitigate that with exercise, with different programs, and that's helped somewhat. Still, we're used to living at what's called standard gravity. Standard gravity is the average gravity on the surface of the Earth, the average force of gravity. Okay, if you're on a tall mountain, the gravity forces on you are going to be less than if you're at the surface of the sea, but okay, it's average. So if we're living in a reduced gravity, our bodies are going to react to that. Our bodies are going to atrophy. Our muscle mass is going to be reduced. Our bone density, because they're not needed in those situations. So long-term life on the moon or Mars is possible, but I think you would have to rotate people off of that periodically to live in one standard gravity for a period of time to recuperate. And so that's what I've incorporated in this science fiction book. I have a Mars base that is largely underground in lava tubes to protect from the ultraviolet radiation, which is another hazard in space. And also to provide an atmosphere that you seal these tubes off and pressurize them. And But you can't change the gravitational force. The Mars is one-third the mass of Earth, and so one-third gravity. So what I've created is an orbiting space station, a tube like a tin can, orbiting Mars, that rotates so that the inner edge of this can produces a standard gravity if you stand on it.
Actually, scientifically, you can make gravity by spinning something like that and being inside.
Absolutely. So there are two ways of creating standard gravity in space. One is practical and one is absurd, but it's possible for a short term period of time. So acceleration is the one that you can imagine going in an elevator in space, or you know, going at a speed and acceleration that produces a standard gravity. Okay. But you can only do that for a short period of time, because as you get into relativistic speeds, it takes more and more energy to keep accelerating until you reach the speed of light, which is impossible. So you're not going to sustain 1g in linear acceleration, but you can produce one gravity with what's called angular acceleration. So that's a rotating body where you're on the inner surface and it's producing one gravity. You can tell, you know, if you're living in such a place, it's pretty easy to determine that you are in a rotating cylinder, even though you may not see outside and see that you are rotating.
Yeah.
But physiologically, and the effects on your body is going to be the same as one gravity on Earth, or standard gravity.
What happens when you drop the apple inside that tube? Does it go straight down? Or
Fly off?
What would Newton have found then?
So you know, if you're trying to drive a golf ball, you're going to have problems. Or throw a football. You know, you get into a whole bunch of dynamics. First of all, the further away from the inner surface you get, the less gravity there is. So if you throw the football too high, it's going to start floating and never come down. So your receiver is going to have a tough time catching that one. If you hit a golf ball, you it's going to be impossible not to hook. You know. So, but yeah, if you dropped a marble or any kind of a ball, it would fall to your feet at a curve. It would curve. So say you're standing right over your foot and you're aiming down to drop it right on your foot. Depending on which way you're facing and which way the tube is rotating, it's going to fall either to the left or the right of your foot. It's not going to hit your foot.
Gotcha. So we have to recalibrate our brains to think in terms of like angular momentum.
That's right. So you could have some pretty creative carnival games, you know, where you're trying to throw... anyway, it's interesting to think about.
Should we colonize Mars or the Moon first?
We'll hit the Moon. NASA has plans for a South Pole Moon base, and one of the reasons for that is there's a big crater down there that is part of it is in perpetual shadow. And they've detected the ice there and maybe a bigger supply of surface ice than other parts. And of course, water and ice are integral to occupation of any area. You're going to have that resource. So they have drawn plans. In fact, in this book, the nonfiction book, The Evolution of Life, I have some drawings by NASA that were commissioned by NASA of South Pole Mars base with launchers that maglev launchers, they're called mass drivers that can launch material into orbit around the moon that could be retrieved in orbit and used to construct the objects, space stations, whatever, in space. So that will be the first step. NASA plans to go back to the moon. And the reason they're going now is they want to set up a virtual Mars trip. So they'll have an orbiter, and they'll have two teams. That one team lives in the South Pole of Mars. The other team lives on the orbiter for 7 or 8 months, which would be the travel time it would take to go to Mars. And then they would switch, and they would do all this testing. My issue with that, or the problem that I foresee, is they're not planning at this point to produce any gravitational effects through rotation on the trip to Mars. So you have 7 months or 8 months of astronauts in some sort of container going to Mars, atrophying, you know, when these astronauts come down from the space station after being up there for a year. That takes them a little bit of time to acclimatize to Earth again, enough to stand and walk around and function. And then it takes them a lot longer to fully recover a lot of the things that have happened in space. So you can imagine the condition these astronauts will be in when they arrive at Mars. And then, yeah, granted, it's only 1/3 gravity, but there's not going to be anybody down there, no medical team to help them off the spaceship and so forth. So that's something that they haven't developed the technology for rotational devices yet. So that's going to be kind of interesting to see. But they will colonize, or I would say not colonize, but have a permanent base on the moon before they do on Mars.
Yeah. It seems to me, just listening to you, it sounds like space is going to be a lot harder than people imagine. It's not going to be Star Trek-ish. But I just wonder if then we don't need exoskeletons to be able to survive or something, so that we can move around and lift objects and those sorts of things.
Those exoskeletons are to give us superhuman strength. They've been proposed for like shock troops and stuff like that, who can run 30 miles an hour and jump over tall buildings and so forth in combat. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things are totally inappropriate for microgravity or reduced gravity, because we already have a problem. Okay, say you're jogging on the moon, for example, in your spacesuit. Okay, you're jogging on the moon. And of course, your stride, you know, you kind of leap jog, you know, because you're so lightweight, even with your spacesuit. So now you want to stop. So there's something called inertia. Those objects in motion tend to want to stay in motion.
Yes.
Those objects at rest tend to want to stay at rest. Well, anyway, so the inertia of your forward motion is the same as it would be on Earth or anywhere else in the universe, but the gravity that holds you to the ground is much less. So you hit the ground and you're going to stop, and you're going to tend to want to do a face plant.
Yes.
And I think, who was it on the first, I think it was on Apollo 11, did exactly that. He was bounding around, and that was,
not Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah, it was Buzz Aldrin. So they didn't show it on camera, and they didn't tell the public about it until much later, because they were a little concerned and a little embarrassed both, I think.
Yeah.
But that's the idea. So you would not need the exoskeleton, but you would need radiation protection, and you would need, the environmental, of course, protection from the cold and the hot. You know, one side of your body would be very, very hot in space, direct to the sun, and the other side would be very cold. So these spacesuits have circulatory systems where they try to even out the heat around your body.
You know, the more I'm listening to you, the more I'm thinking, how the heck are we going to get off of this planet? And if we do, we probably shouldn't even think about coming back. We just evolve into the new environment, because they're so different, right? So what is your vision of us getting off of this planet?
So there are a number of issues that, and a lot of them are social. Okay, so there's, if you're going to build societies in space, say, you're going to have to screen people, the applicants who want to do this, in a very sophisticated way. You're going to have to screen out psychopaths. You're going to have to screen out people who are mentally ill. You're going to have to ensure that you're not going to have any aberrant members of the society, because they could destroy the whole, one person could destroy the whole thing. So that's number one. And then living in these enclosed environments, we're absolutely not used to that. We like the big sky of Montana. You know, we like to be in the open spaces, even on islands. If we're not used to living on islands and we vacation on an island, pretty soon we're thinking like, oh, this is pretty small. I need to get back to the mainland. So the psychological, sociological issues need to be addressed. And then, of course, environmentally, we need to be able to grow our own food. We need to be able to produce our own atmosphere. And those things will not be done necessarily mechanically. We're going to involve microorganisms to a large extent, producing food and so forth, and an atmosphere. And we're going to have full ecological systems that will have to be implemented in these environments. And then to maintain the one reason I wanted that I propose standard gravity in these is so that we don't devolve, or we don't evolve away from our base humanity. Right,
become blobs.
And the other issue is a sequestered population. So if you have a small population that's reproducing, you start to decrease your gene pool. Mm-hmm. And you become, eventually you may become a new species. And mutations in space, because of the stresses, will probably be at a higher rate than on Earth. So we would have to address that if we want to maintain our humanity. And in my novel that I'm finishing up, I propose that people will want to maintain their connection to Earth, even when we're on track to another star system.
Right.
This is our birthplace. This is our identity. Our eyes see in the spectrum that is most powerful from the sun, so it's tied to the sun. Our bodies developed in standard gravity. We want to maintain that. Our genetics evolved on this planet. It's not hard to maintain a diversified gene pool. You can take frozen, you know, germ cells with you. You can take a large, and then as a matter of fact, in the future, you could probably store the DNA, large amounts of DNA information in computers. And then when you wanted to diversify or add diversity to your population, you just start building some DNA and switching it out in viable cells, and presto bango, you have a new person. Very possible. That's the science of it. What about the social part? What about our conflict? What about people who are unethical, people who are greedy, all the problems of our present society? What about
absolutely that? How do we let me ask you another question then. As an experiment, why don't we try and live in the ocean instead of in space? Is it harder in the ocean or harder in space to live?
It would be harder in space. Well, it's interesting you bring that up. My novel is called Outbound, Islands in the Void. Okay. And it should be out hopefully before Christmas, but I was trying to target the early fall, but it'll be late fall. And one of the things that I project the book is in about 260 years in the future from now. And we've gone through a climate crisis. We've gone through which and some wars. So the Earth is sort of dystopian, and is trying to recover from the disaster of the climate crisis, where I propose maybe a couple of billion people, 2 or 3 billion people have died because of heat, because of starvation, because of wars and disruptions of various sorts. So at 250, 260 years in the future, Earth is trying to put itself back together. At the same time, we're building colonies and we're building islands in space where a select few people who have been pre-screened in all of this are living there, and they're developing resources from the asteroid belt, sending them into a group of islands close to in Earth orbit that then manufacture or produce stuff and send it down to Earth. And there's things going on Earth where the whole center of the whole center part, from the equator, from the Tropic of Cancer to the Tropic of Capricorn, that whole band around the Earth is basically uninhabitable in my scenario. The Amazon is essentially dead. It's an area, arid area. And people have moved toward the temperate and toward the poles. Populations have moved. Those people who are able to move have. So there's a lot of disruption. And one of the solutions, they're building islands in the sea. They're building their habitats, but they're sanctuaries against the violence in some of these areas in society, where they can float these things out using a lot of the technology and used in space to grow food, to manufacture things, to have fish farms and so forth. So yes, we have more sea surface than we have land surface. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of islands or floating environments in the sea is you can move away from disaster. You can move away from these hurricanes. You can move away from the hot temperatures. This spring, the temperature of the water off the Florida Keys reached 101 or 102 degrees.
I'm feeling it because I'm in Texas and it is very hot here this year.
Yeah. I can't imagine. You know, it's a spa down in the Florida Keys. You go in there and add some bubbles.
You got it going on. This, you know what? I seriously could just sit here and just talk to you about this for like hours, because I think this is a fascinating subject that we've got going on here. I want to learn some more about you. I want to get your opinion about things that are space related, but not necessarily in the book and everything. And I want to play a little game with you called This or That. We're going to talk about, I'll ask you a question. You get two options. You can choose one or the other, but not neither or both. So you are roped into those two. You can explain one if you want to, but we'll see if we can, what we can go with. We'll start with the easy ones and we'll get a little harder. Just choose one or the other. And it's you decide what the question means. Okay. What about, we just talked about this, but or ocean exploration or space exploration?
Well, ocean is going on at more intensity than space. So I would pick ocean.
Okay. How about, I don't know, Big Bang or steady state theory?
Big Bang.
Okay. Extinct animals or endangered animals?
Endangered.
Yeah. It seems like we need to figure out how to save some of them, don't we?
Right, exactly.
Astrobiology or astronomy?
Astrobiology.
Okay. Explain astrobiology for folks that have never heard of it.
This would be how life might exist in other areas of space. What are the conditions and what would that life look like? I think that's the thing that we're really looking at today, mm-hmm. because of the possibility of living in space.
Okay. We talked about this during a little while ago, but human colonization of Mars or Moon?
Moon.
Okay. Natural evolution or genetic engineering?
I'll say genetic engineering, only because that's going to happen in the future.
Okay.
And we're going to have to deal with a lot of ethical issues there.
We are. It's kind of like the same issues we're dealing with AI right now, right?
Exactly.
Alien life with carbon-based biology or silicon-based biology?
Carbon. Hands down, carbon.
Okay. Why? Because I've looked at silicon-based a little bit. What's the deal?
Silicon is very similar to carbon in that the what's called the valence of electrons are free. The outer orbital has space for four electrons, as carbon does. However, those orbitals are further from the atom nucleus and thus are less firmly bound. So silicon cannot form long chains. And silicon, we use silicon, the element, to form silicone, which resemble rubber. But that bond is silicon, oxygen, silicon, it alternates. So it can't form long chains. It can't form complex molecules like carbon can. So carbon, they don't even know how many possible molecules carbon can form, but it's in the millions.
Okay.
Silicon,
not so much.
So it's silicon, not so much. Plus, silicon looks like a rock, and I don't know if you, and it's not water soluble. So, you know, how is it going to produce a metabolism? You know, the chemistry of life as such.
All right.
I'm going to stick
with carbon then.
Yeah.
How about save a dying star or explore a black hole?
What was the first one?
Save a dying star or explore a black hole.
Explore a black hole. There's no way we can save a dying star.
Okay. Some people might say we can't explore a black hole either, but
I think from a distance.
From a distance. Oh, how about, let's go a little harder. How about conscious AI or human consciousness expansion?
Human consciousness expansion, but I have to put a caveat in there and say that they may be the same thing. They may be working in concert. I have created an artificial intelligence in my science fiction novel that interfaces with a character's brain, and so part of that artificial intelligence being is human, and part of it is artificial intelligence, and they have a synergistic kind of relationship, double personality, but you know. So it's given me a lot of fun trying to develop the dynamic between this artificial intelligence that is sentient and a human intelligence.
Interesting. I'm about to read your book for sure. So, preserve Earth's biodiversity or build off-world habitats?
Preserve Earth's biodiversity first. That's we don't have another Earth. We don't have anywhere else to go. We have to take care of our own planet. You know, we can't pollute our own bed. You know, we have to. It's going to be a long time. Well, how many? We have 7 billion people on this planet.
Mm-hmm. At least, right?
Yeah, at least it's growing. By the end of the century, they anticipate maybe 11 billion people, and that's with a reducing birth rate because the population base is so large. So you cannot possibly move anywhere near that many people into space, even if you had the habitats built and so forth. There's no way. So we better preserve what we have. We've got a good billion years or so before Earth becomes uninhabitable, before the sun expands, maybe a 5 billion years. But I think before that time, it's going to get too hot to handle, so to speak, and human life would be not possible on this planet. But gotcha. we have some time to develop space. So we better make sure we can use all the time we have on Earth left.
Yeah, you know, people get lazy; they wait to the last minute. So we'll see what happens with that.
we're really good at handling disasters, not so much good at preventing
planning for them. Yeah. So what about study extinct civilizations or search for intelligent extraterrestrial life?
What the first one was, what would
study extinct
Earth
civilizations?
I think I would study extinct Earth civilizations and the evolution of man. There's a lot of gaps in that program to get more data and information on how we evolved. I think it's highly unlikely we'll get a signal from extraterrestrial intelligence.
Okay.
You have to have surface life on a planet. You cannot have sea life. Octopi and porpoises and these intelligent animals cannot broadcast signals to communicate outside of their local environment in the sea. They can't develop technology because they can't have fire. So you have to have life on the surface of a planet that evolves for a long period of time. And if you look at a place like Mars, well, or Venus, the surface is not a viable place. There's high UV radiation on Mars. There's sulfuric acid in the atmosphere.
You just killed my whole, like, under the sea with Nemo and all those guys now. No fire.
Yeah, you better have a very strong-sided submarine.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. Dang it, Disney. All right. How about unlimited space travel with environmental impact or limited space travel with sustainability?
Limited with sustainability.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's do some thought-provoking. How about if there were aliens? How about ethical treatment of alien species or human primacy?
Well, ethical treatment, but our history doesn't point to that, does it?
Not.
So hopefully, if that event would happen in the future, we would have socially involved enough to realize the value of a cooperative contact. And why would we be a threat or they be a threat? I mean, the science fiction story is the aliens come to Earth because their planet is dying and they want to take it over and exterminate. You know, that makes a good science fiction story. I don't think it's that likely.
Is it like you've I just finished the three body problem. We talk about dark forest theory where any alien species that finds another one, if they find them fast enough, they want to wipe them out because they assume that they're going to get wiped out first. Do you think aliens are going to be friendly, or are they going to want to wipe out the next species they find?
Let's say tomorrow we made contact and the aliens had reached Earth. Mm-hmm. They would have technology that was so far advanced from ours that they wouldn't, I believe, would not feel a threat from us. Would they have a desire to take over our beautiful planet? Well, if we polluted enough, maybe not. But that's a possibility. Would they want to exterminate us? I'm not sure I would see the motivation for that.
Yeah.
The same idea with, not quite the same, but with artificial intelligence, should it become a sentient and more powerful than our own minds, would it want to destroy humans? And you have to ask yourself, well, what would be in it for them? Why would they want to do that? Why? Because they want to live in our mansions or drive our yachts or our sports cars? No. Yeah. The material things, I would imagine, would not be a desire that artificial intelligent sentient being would really have. They have wouldn't have those kinds of ego needs.
We are going to have to do a whole show on that, because I think it would be interesting to see what would happen if we let the artificial, at least one of them, kind of just learn on its own rather than hampering it and let it come to some conclusions instead of saying it's going off the rails. It'd be very interesting, I think, to see.
Yeah, that is an evolving, a fast evolving field. And the mm-hmm. fear is it's going to get away from us, which I think is going to happen.
Yeah, it will, because we're not smart enough. Let me see. Let me ask. I got two more for you. Redirect human evolution or let nature decide?
Nature has been pretty good at deciding. And that being said, it doesn't always have an ideal platform to build on. So mm-hmm. evolution is like you take a car, a gasoline car, and you want to make it an electric car. So you pull the engine out, you put an electric motor in, you put the battery in the trunk, and voila, you have an electric car. Well, that's what evolution does. It builds on what previously exists. Or a better way is to do what Tesla has done and build it from the ground up, totally new design, batteries low at a low point in the weight distribution. And it's highly efficient, but evolution doesn't work that way. We don't rebuild it. But with bioengineering, yeah, you could go back and correct some things, particularly genetic diseases. I see a lot of potential there. There has been some work in that area. So you can excise DNA from a person with a genetic disorder. You can tweak it. You can put in different, you can correct it. In other words, correct the damage that is causing the problem, reinsert it. It's been done in sickle cell anemia, one case that I know of with a teenage boy, and he was homozygous for sickle cell. So his lifespan was predicted to be, you know, into the 20s. And they actually excised some of his bone marrow, which is what makes the blood. And they excised the one, it was called the point mutation, excised mm-hmm. the one nucleic acid, inserted the correct one, grew it in tissue culture, and re-injected it into his bone marrow. Now, instead of being effectively homozygous, he was effectively heterozygous. So he wouldn't have the severe crisis, and he could lead a pretty normal life.
Pretty amazing.
That was an easy fix. Some of the others, like cystic fibrosis, you know, they have many, many mutations. But that's the future of, that's the beginning of the future of messing with our own DNA.
Let me ask you one more question, and kind of along that line. Know the future of humanity's evolution or understand the exact origin of life?
I think the future history, the future. The understanding the origin is kind of academic. It's nice to know, but it's kind of academic. The future is our future.
Man, would you jump off the boat now or wait for it to go down? I don't know.
Well, if you jump off now, you can swim away, I guess. But
yeah. I want people to be able to stay in touch with you for sure. I think you are absolutely fascinating. You've got your website, richardandersonauthor.com. And for people who are listening, it's Richard, all one word, Richard Anderson Author, AUTHOR.com. And we've also got your amazing book, The Evolution of Life, Big Bang to Space Colonies. You can get that on Amazon, guys. And I'm just mind blown. Just real quick, I got one last thing for you. What science fiction show is closest to being real? Which one do you think it is? Are there any?
Yeah, there are parts of some that are based in reality. And I would say Star Trek would have some things that are scientifically based. Most of it is so far out there that it's just, and Star Wars is just a space cowboy movie. It has no relation to reality. The Martian was not a TV show, but it was a movie and a book. And that comes pretty close to scientific possibility and reality.
All right.
So that's my take. Okay. I love this. I love science fiction fantasy, however.
I do too. I love it all the way from Bradbury up to whoever the latest person is that's writing. So it's good stuff.
Right.
Thank you for being on. I have loved talking with you. You guys check out Richard on richardandersonauthor.com, and we'll see everybody in the future. Later, everybody.
Bye-bye.